All right, so we're continuing on with these YAL 2012 talks with speakers. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Kurt Schrader. I'm CTO at a company called Intent Media.
Okay.
And I also co-organize a big group of people in New York City called CTO School, where we basically bring in senior technical leaders and teach them about things and that you wouldn't normally do as a developer. So things like how to do marketing, how to hire people, how to keep your developers happy, things like that.
Yes. So you come from a development background, I assume.
I do. I have a computer engineering degree from long ago, and I have built software professionally since I was, I think, about 14 years old.
Nice, man.
With the Microsoft Fox Pro many years ago.
Wow, you're one of those people.
Yeah.
There's lots of you, actually.
Yeah, well, I'm not one of those people. I hardly remember it, but you know, Java and Ruby and Clojure and a bunch of other things over the years. Mm. And we started this company about 3 or 4 years ago, and I brought in to build the software and build the team. And I've moved from originally building software. Now I go to meetings all day and build the team. We've grown from 6 to about 66 people over the last 3.5 years. So things are going really well.
So I mean, the obvious question to ask right off the bat is, how do you build an engineering team? How do you hire, what do you tell these CTO wannabes? Or what I mean by that is people who are technical leaders that want to then build a team.
Sure.
Tell me how you do that.
Well, it's, first of all, I ask them if it's something they're really interested in, right? Mm. There's lots of people who get sort of shoved into management roles and end up saying, I'm a manager, but I hate this. I want to write code all day. And I think, the first thing you want to figure out about yourself is, do you want to write code all day? And that should be a perfectly reasonable career path. If you want to write code all day, come talk to me. I'll hire you to write code all day. And, if you're managing people and don't want to do it, I'm your guy. But, once you've made that decision, it's a new skill set. You sort of have to look at it as a separate skill set that you have to build up. I think a lot of people go into it and think, oh, I'll just do this as a chunk of my other job or something like that. And sometimes that works okay. But you really have to realize that your job is changing and you have to, keeping people happy and dealing with, small disputes before they turn into big disputes. And not just walking back to your keyboard and saying, I'm not going to deal with that right now, I'm going to write some code, because that's easier, is not the right thing to do a lot of times. So you want to build up the ability to just, connect with people and sort of figure out how to put the pieces together and be responsible for not just the piece of code you're working on, but for, the entire system and the entire software system you're trying to build up. And you just have to move over that line and start to move in that direction.
I could imagine that you can't be a CTO and not have deep technical knowledge. Are you finding that that's not always the case?
You'd be surprised. I think generally it works much better to have a CTO with technical knowledge. sometimes you see people with a product background, but they usually were development or programmer and then did some product work and moved into being a CTO over the years. So, but yeah, I think it definitely helps, right? If you try to come in and be a CTO as a business guy or something like that, and you haven't done the development work, your team's not going to respect you, and they're going to ignore half of what you say, right? And I can already feel that sometimes. I don't have time to write code at work anymore, but I write code at pretty much every weekend in order to, stay out there. And I came in as a pretty good developer, and I hired a lot of great developers, and they continue to move, and I'm slow, trying to play catch up a lot of times.
Understood.
It's definitely helps a lot when you have that background to just connect with people, connect with the right people you want to hire, figure out what developers are going to be good, which ones aren't going to be, and bring in the right group of guys and build things out that way.
So what makes a good developer?
There's so many different kinds of good developers. I think the one thing that that we usually see when we hire new people or young people, things like that, is sort of the first step you need to take is getting used to delivering. Like a lot of people, if you come out of university or something like that, are used to being able to mess around, not do a whole lot, this sort of thing. And at least in our business, and a lot of startup businesses, you got to get stuff out the door. And sometimes I see people with this attitude, but a lot of times I run into people who are sort of like, oh, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this. And I go over and say, what's going on? It's like, we've tried 10 different things, and it's like, that's interesting. Is that done? Well, no, it's not done yet, that sort of thing. So so I think the first step is doing that. But beyond that, it's just, I think there's a component of curiosity, right? Like, if you want to keep learning, you want to keep building on what you've learned before, I'm going to give exactly the opposite of advice I just gave, but, you know, you're trying things, right? You know, you're still pushing things out the door, but you're trying to get better at it all the time, right? And continuously improving yourself and the way you write software, I think, is how you get to be a better and better developer.
Sure. Now, are you finding it's hard to find qualified developers?
It depends on how you define qualified, but...
Like you were mentioning, somebody that could come in with a run, not walk, not crawl, and help ship software for a project.
Yeah, I mean, I think there it has been hard. We've grown quite a bit, and you know, part of it is the fact that we're doing well and we have money, which helps out a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I've seen lately is, especially in New York and San Francisco. I lived in San Francisco for a while. Now I live in New York. Mm-hmm. Is there's a lot of good developers who I would normally try to hire who are starting small startups, which I'm all for, but it makes it more difficult because a lot of the guys who are good and 24, 25, 26 years old are out there doing their own thing, and you know, there's a lot of money sort of sloshing around, and they're sucking up a lot of like the small pockets of talent, and that makes it harder, right? Mm. Hopefully those guys will come out of that this year, next year, and either their companies will succeed or they'll fail, and they'll be looking for something else to do, and I can, you know, pull some of them out, but that's definitely changing the market a little bit. And then, you know, beyond that, the thing is, back to like learning and changing, I interview a lot of people, or I see a lot of resumes for people that have been doing this for, you know, 10 or 15 years, and they've just been doing the same thing. Like, you know, maybe they made a change from C++ to Java or something like that, but they're still doing Java. And it's just like you can look at their resume pretty quickly and say, you know, this person hasn't been growing. Like, they're not going to fit here because they're not going to be growing. And usually, you know, occasionally I talk to those people, and very occasionally someone says, I've been stuck in this big company. I can't do anything. I can't get anything done. They won't let me change anything. I really want to change something. And sometimes those guys work out really well. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times I run across people who look at this and say, I am just doing this, you know, as my job. I don't really care about being a good developer, and I've been doing the same thing over and over and over again for a long time. And if you don't take the time to learn and try to continue to keep up with what's going on, like that makes it difficult. And there's a lot of people out there like that.
Sure. And it also seems to be like a lot of developers will sort of mark their territory or put a flag down and say that I'm a Scala developer, which is now the hot thing, or I'm a Clojure developer, which is now sort of the hot thing. And it's like, or I'm a Java developer, which is sort of has been, or I'm a .NET developer, which is sort of, you know, a little further advanced than Java as far as the has been-ness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then of course you have the C++ developers who are still C++ developers because the world happens to need drivers and operating systems and, you know, real applications that need to have performance, all, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and they mark their territory as this, then you have game developers. So, you know, my question is, and I asked Dave Thomas this today as well, I mean, do you see a trend where developers actually are engaged in adding new tools to their toolbox? Because it seems like, you know, I like to use drills, so I'm going to use this drill for everything because I'm an expert driller. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you seeing this amongst the young guys?
A little bit. You know, the way that we handle it to some extent is when you come in to Intent Media, you're a developer, and we have a Rails application. We have ad server written in Java. We've got a bunch of back-end Hadoop stuff written mostly in Java. We also have some Clojure in there, a little bit of Python, a bunch of different things, right? And if you, in order to get done with what you need to get done, you need to work on it, you need to pick that up. And we don't discriminate. Jumping from language to language, moving from something like an object-oriented language to something like Clojure is a bit of a big jump for a lot of people. So we have maybe a few people that sort of work on that most of the time. But if you can't move from Ruby to Java to C# to even C++, although sometimes, you know, even I forget that quite a bit. If you can't move between similar languages pretty easily, like, it just doesn't seem that hard to me. So you know, we make people start to do it right away. And you know, actually, I mean, most of the guys I see coming out of university are younger guys, either come in with like, I know 10 things and I can set up your Unix box, or like, I've been trained by the school, I know Java or I know Python or I know something like that. So we do have to train still a good number of people and sort of, you know, put them, you know, just shove them into the deep end. Here's a Rails app, here's a feature, fix it. It's rolling out when you finish it in a few days. And it's not that hard. I mean, you know, maybe they're not writing the best Ruby code in the world, but yeah. I don't know if that really matters at the end of the day. It's better to sort of broaden those people out. And then when something comes up where you need to be all hands on deck to put something out the door on that side, people can work on it together.
Interesting. And do you hire like C++ developers? Do you guys do any of that work?
We don't do any C++ work. I'm trying to think. I mean, if you hire enough developers, eventually some of them have a C++ background.
So you guys mainly are web shop?
Yeah, yeah. We build ad servers and yeah, web software and things like that. So
cool.
But you know, generally a lot of Java, a lot of Ruby, a lot of JavaScript now. JavaScript is you know, we built our extranet in Ruby, but you know, vast portions of it are moving into the JavaScript layer, and you know, we've fiddled a little bit with JavaScript on the back end. We don't do a whole lot with that yet, but a lot of people do at this point. So sure. Things are moving in that direction, definitely.
That's interesting. And what are some of the like the big problems you think faces a developer? Right. So what I mean by that is like I'm a developer coming out of school. Doesn't matter what university I went to. If I went to MIT, I learned Python because that's what the professor's like. And if I went to anyone else or anywhere else, I'm learning Java because apparently that's also what the professor's like. But that won't necessarily help you in the real world, as you mentioned, because I'm going to have this addiction to objects and stuff and statically typed languages in the case of Java, right, for sure. So how does someone like that have a chance in passing one of your interviews? I mean,
we will take a good Java developer. We'll take a good Python developer. I mean, one of the guys that works for me now, I don't know if he did anything but Python before he came in the door, but you know, we have a code test people do, and we say, do it in Java or do it in Ruby. Figure out one of those and do it. And I think he did it in Ruby and, you know, flew through it, right? Like, if you're so, you know, if your brain is so boxed in that you can only think in one thing, it's going to hurt you. First of all, we've seen this before. The industry always moves, right? Like if you're doing C++ from 20 years ago, you're probably not employable either at this point, because you know that's moved so far ahead. And you know, you said some of the .NET stuff is a little more legacy than Java. Well, it was for a little bit, I think, and now it's ahead. Like if you look at the new C# languages, they're pulling a lot of cool stuff back into there. If you look at Java 8 and 9, they're pulling a lot of stuff from Scala, and like a lot of the good ideas there are coming back in. And and if you're writing Java, you know, 4 or 5 or whatever, and if, you know, we get code tests occasionally that it's clear this guy, I think Java changed their numbering, so he's be called 1.3 or something, right? You see old code and it's not using sort of all the new stuff in the language, and you go, you know, this guy hasn't been learning things. Like they're writing Java every day in their job. They can use this. Why aren't they using it? And and you're going to see, you know, now Java's going to play catch up to C# again, and they're going to take all the good ideas from Scala, as far as I can tell, or at least most of them, as many of them as they can pull in and you know, let people use them in there. And you know, I don't think you have any choice at some point to move forward with the industry, right? Like you know, if we pull in those ideas from Scala, if we pull in a lot of functional programming stuff into the mainstream languages, you're either going to have to figure out how to use them and adapt to them, or you're not going to be employable, not by me, but by anyone at some point, right?
Sure.
Especially as we move to, you know, more multiprocessor stuff. We do stuff across 40, 50, 100 machines with MapReduce, and you have to do it with functions a lot of time. As soon as you get side effects, everything starts to fall apart.
Yep.
So, you know, that's the way things are moving. There's nothing that you or I or anybody can do about it. And if you're not learning those things, be it now and, you know, Scala or something more esoteric like Clojure or whatever it is, and you know, for a while you could float on your, I just know object oriented, I can do object oriented, but sooner or later, and I think probably sooner, you're going to have to start to internalize some of this stuff, and it's a different way of thinking, and you know, I think it'll push the industry forward, but it'll leave some people behind at some point.
Totally. Well, I mean, yeah, I think everyone should learn more than one language.
Yeah.
And you know, we talk about that quite a bit on Channel 9. I think C# is a beautiful language. but it's a tool for a specific job. Now, it's general purpose, so you can use it for a lot of jobs. There's certain jobs where it just doesn't make any sense.
Sure.
And that's true for pretty much every language.
Totally. Yeah, and I mean, Microsoft has done some cool stuff, like pushing out F-sharp and things like that, you know, hopefully you just do your normal Visual Studio install, and you're like, what's this F-sharp? And you can start to figure out some of that stuff, which is cool.
So what are you talking about here?
So I was talking about building a big data engineering team. So one thing that I've dealt with over the last 3 or 4 years is, you know, I came in, you know, these guys started this company that I worked for in Temp Media. We had 3 co-founders, and their idea was, let's go into e-commerce websites. Let's look at users, figure out who's going to buy things and not buy things. And then the people that aren't going to buy things, we're going to serve them competitive ads. So we work with, say, Expedia. And, you know, when we look at every user that comes into Expedia and says, this person's likely to buy or not going to buy. And if they're not likely to buy, we serve ads for other, you know, online travel agencies, Orbitz and other airlines, United, things like that, that you can actually click through and make money on, all the people that aren't buying things from your website. So, you know, I came in and built my normal team and built up all the stuff I would normally build. And then we sort of realized, like, okay, we have to build big data statistical models, and none of us had ever done that before. And how do you build a team to do that? You know, what are the kind of people you're looking for? How do you put that together and, you know what to build, what kind of models? How do you deal with, you know, we have hundreds of terabytes of data. How do you deal with that sort of stuff? And it's all a new set of challenges. And when you go out there and look at things, you know, you either get 5,000 tools if you look up big data on the web, or you get use cases from things like Google, and they've got, you know, just take this data and run it against 10,000 machines, which wasn't really helpful to us, right? Mm-hmm. So we had to figure out, sort of muddle our way through it. So I tried to sort of, you know, lay down some easy rules about how to get started and move in and build out this team as you go forward.
Excellent. So I would imagine this team would be, you need a data scientist maybe?
Yeah, we need a data scientist. We've hired a bunch of data scientists. So, and we've made some mistakes hiring data scientists. Mm. And, you know, the big thing that I've learned there is, you know, when you get stuck in this problem space and you're trying to figure out what, you know, what to hire for a data scientist, your sort of instinct is like, let's hire a statistician, let's hire a mathematician. But what you want to do is hire someone that can do statistics, knows math, has built some models, but also can write code, because you still got that interface there. And I liken it to people that have worked in a big company where you have an architect and he comes in and says, here's a new tool, use it. And then he leaves, and I don't know what he does for the next 3 months, but then he comes back later and says, did you use the new tool? Did it solve our problems? I don't care. Here's another new tool, that sort of thing. And I think a lot of us have dealt with those guys. And when you just hire in someone who is a data scientist who just knows the math, then you end up with a white paper. Here's the model. This is the perfect model. And then, you know, as engineers, we have to figure out how to, you know, implement that, you know, figure out whether or not it's possible to do it, you know, find all the loose edges, like move it into reality. And a lot of times that's hard. So if you have people that can deal with the data, write the code, figure out things like that, but also know a lot of the math, it makes your life a lot easier.
Absolutely. Definitely found that. I mean, you'd hope so. I mean, you should be able to find developers who are good at math.
Yeah.
And not, you know, that's one of the things. You don't need any math background whatsoever, and you could still be a developer and have a very productive lifestyle, depending on what you're doing.
Totally, yeah. And I mean, this is, data scientists is, you know, statistics, right?
Yep.
So you find people with some, you know, I took statistics in university, but it was 15 years ago or whenever it was, and, you know, just recharging that part of the brain, it's a little bit of a little different path to walk down than I'm used to.
And it's interesting because one of the speakers, John Cook, is one of your fellow speakers here at Yahoo. He's a statistician, mathematicians type. Uses R. Of course, now he's like a preeminent R user and speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And R is one of those languages which isn't the world's best designed language, but it's perfect for its domain, which is statistics.
Exactly.
And analysis over big data.
Yeah.
You find sort of what's going on in sort of the outlying areas of this massive amount of data. It's super powerful, so hire an R developer, man, if you can find them.
Yeah, no, we have hired a couple of R developers, but
cool.
You know, the yeah, and like you said, you as a computer scientist, when you look at R, you're kind of like, oh man, this was designed by people that didn't know what they're doing. Sort of like if you can see a lot of Perl code like that, right? Where you're like, ah, what is this? You know, but it came out of a real need, and that makes it really powerful for doing a lot of the stuff that you want to use whenever you have that need. Like, it works really, really well. Like, you know, I don't know if you can write a web app in R, but you know, for statistical analysis, it works just wonderfully.
Totally. And so what kind of trends are you seeing in the industry? So technical trends.
Okay. I think the one that I mentioned earlier definitely is more functional programming stuff coming back into the
still
mainstream.
Happening. All right.
Yeah. And, you know, we've been saying this for longer than I've been alive, that the functional stuff is eventually going to come back and be there. You know, Hopefully it's real this time. Like, it's going to have to be real at some point just because of the way hardware is going. So we'll see what happens there. Another trend I see, and this has been sort of like went up and it feels like it's coming back down a little bit, I hope, is you know, endless parade of NoSQL databases and databases solving problems that could probably better be solved by a SQL database or a structured database. I know I disagree with some people here at this conference about this, but you know, one thing I've definitely found when we started this company was sort of like 3.5-4 years ago, was like everybody was out there with their NoSQL database and they were just coming along and lots of cool stuff, and I was sort of like, oh, let's try to build this on a NoSQL database. And we set one up, and which will remain nameless, threw a bunch of data into it, and you know, it crashed. We said, all right, screw that. We'll use MySQL. We've done this before. Mm-hmm. And the side effect, the big thing that I had never thought about was, you know, I've got 65 people in my company, and probably 60 of them know how to write some SQL, which never really processed in my mind. But we do a lot of exposing of our data. So we have different data stores now. We have Vertica data store, MySQL, a backend, a bunch of things. And if people can access your raw data, terabytes of data, using SQL, that's one less thing that I, as a developer, have to do at the end of the day. If I have to write a MapReduce job in JavaScript, I'm not going to tell the intern who just came out, who you know is a marketing intern, to do that. But for some reason, everyone knows SQL. I can't figure out why. I guess most people are just exposed to it over the years in one way or another. So you know, people can grab these tools and build things up and build up a lot of their own reports and, you know, tweak models and build their own models and figure things out, and then feed that back into a lot of the engineering work we're doing. So, you know, that really, I think, helped us a lot, especially for us when we were, you know, resource constrained for a while. You know, not resource constrained, but when you're a startup, you've got 10, 20, 30 people, and if you've got something that needs to get done, there might be 10 other things that have to get done before it. So if somebody else can jump on that because that's what they need, it makes their life a lot easier.
Sure.
But yeah, I think we saw a lot of NoSQL stuff, and it's sort of tapered off, and people are finding the right place to fit into their architecture with a bunch of other things. I mean, we use a couple of NoSQL databases, but we use them for very specific purposes. There was a trend that was sort of gaining steam to use them as sort of your general purpose data store, and I think that's kind of died a little bit because people realized it wasn't any better than what was out there.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think I see that a lot in this industry. I mean, having been doing Channel 9 for far too long, probably, and also being in the industry for a while, it's like anything else. There's fashion, yep. Right? And so, you know, the fashion today, like I was saying, the fashionable thing is Scala and Clojure. Mm-hmm. And the functional stuff is still fashionable, except that it's wrapped in imperative clothing.
Yeah.
So that, like in C#, you're using Link.
Yep.
Well, that's an implementation of functional programming.
Totally.
Right? It's that Eric Meyer got his hands into that stuff, and look what we have here.
Yep.
And lambdas, of course, and stuff like that. But I mean, the problem with the functional world is that they overcomplicate things. So I mean, as you were saying, a general purpose programmer should never have to hear the term monad, because it doesn't mean anything in the context of what they're doing.
Yep.
It might definitely mean something in the implementation of some of the lower levels of what is in front of them.
Yep.
But I mean, Link is essentially a monad.
Yep.
But who cares?
Yeah,
it doesn't
exactly
matter.
Yeah.
So anyway, the moral of the story is that, you know, the trend is put functional constructs into imperative languages, because then most of the world's
general purpose programmers are imperative programmers, and they won't get scared away. Totally. And that's gonna keep happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
Or just go functional and use Clojure or use whatever, or, you know, use Haskell. Haskell, amazing, but
yeah,
you know, wrap your head around that coming from C#.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think to that point, like, Clojure as a functional language is a great one to try. You bring up Scala a couple times. It's really easy to write Java code in Scala, so it's easy to like not really learn what you want to learn. If you really want to stretch your mind and sort of move in the right direction, pick up something like Clojure, because you can't write Java code in Clojure, or at least I don't know how to. I know there's at least one IDE where you can copy a piece of Java's code and say paste as Scala, and it will actually turn it into valid Scala over here. So okay. I see a lot of that bad Scala and different Java moving things over to Scala, that sort of thing. And if you want to really get out of that box and move over here, like something like Clojure is a great tool to run through and figure that out with.
Cool. Right on. Well, hey, man, great to meet you. And
yeah.
Good luck with your company.
Thank you.
And, keep employing developers, man.
Cool. I always.
Rock and roll.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.